Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks for joining us for today's show. As usual, you can watch us on Facebook Live. Just go to the GPB news page on Facebook, or you can and you can communicate with us on Facebook Live, as many of you already do. You can also tweet us at PoliticsGPB. And I don't mention it enough, but I should. If you can't be with us when we're on the radio, you can always watch the broadcast on Facebook. But you can also subscribe to our podcast, the Political Rewind podcast, at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast from. So, Greg Bluestein, political reporter from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Good to have you with us for today's show.
Thanks for having me. You're right before the holidays.
That's what I was about to ask you. You have been working so hard throughout this entire election year. Are you going to get a little time off?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to be gone pretty much all of next week.
All right. Good, good. Just come back when we're back on the air in a couple of weeks. We'll talk about that schedule in a minute. Amy Steigerwalt is right next to you. She's political science professor at Georgia State University. Amy, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're glad. Always glad to have
Emory undergrad, though, if that helps.
There you go. Emory undergrad, and where'd you do your graduate work?
Berkeley.
Berkeley. Oh, well, we know
where
you are serious business. And Patricia Murphy, who is a columnist for Roll Call and for The Daily Beast, and is also your writing for Garden and Gun. What kind of pieces are you filing for Garden and Gun? I'm assuming they're not political.
They are not at all political. I call it my palate cleanser. Yes, I do a lot of travel pieces.
Oh, good.
Some falconry, some beachcombing. It's really terrible.
Wow.
Where was the best travel place you went to for the column?
Well, I did get to go to Ted Turner's private island, which he has just gifted with a small fee back to the state of South Carolina, which will soon be a state park that people from South Carolina and everywhere, all of us can go to together.
Has that piece appeared in the magazine yet?
It's in the current issue with the pretty black dog on the cover.
Okay, yes. So people who read Garden and Gun will definitely want to look at that. Patricia also worked on the Hill for Max Cleland when he was in the U.S. Senate, for Sam Nunn before that. So you have those credentials as well.
Yes, thank you.
All right. By the way, all of these folks and Jim Galloway were in the studio with us late this morning. We recorded a show that we're going to bring to you next Monday, December 31st at 2 o'clock, the top 10 political stories in Georgia of 2018. And I think we had a pretty good mix of stories, Bluestein.
Yeah, we were up and down. We were all across the board, but we had a lot of election-related stories and policy-related stories and Diehl and Kemp and Abrams-related stories.
Okay, Tom Faust is saying in my ear, it's also going to be broadcast on GPB TV on the 30th. Sunday, December 30th at 9 a.m. So you could listen to it then. All right. So let's get to town on our live show today, Greg Bluestein. Your colleague Jim Galloway had a terrific column this morning, and he starts it by saying, let's forget for a minute the federal judge in Texas who just ruled Obamacare unconstitutional, and let's proceed essentially under the impression that Obamacare probably will remain legal, that the appeals courts may very well reverse what the judge did. But regardless of that, it's interesting because on this show the other day, I asked the question of whether that ruling would disincentivize Georgia legislators from considering expanding Medicaid under ACA. Galloway is picking up signals, as I'm sure you are, that they're still talking about it.
You got it. I mean, if you're under the assumption that either, even if it is struck down, that it would take years or months for this, at least months, but maybe years for the case to wind its way through the legal system, or it could be overturned by the appeals court or even the Supreme Court, then you've got a plan for now. And you're hearing an increasing number of lawmakers either outright open to Medicaid expansion, which we know will not happen under Brian Kemp because he's vowed that it won't happen many, many different times, or some sort of Medicaid waiver program. And Jim is sort of outlining maybe a grand compromise there.
There's a quote in his column from Terry England, who, of course, is the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. There was a phone call, Greg, if I have this straight, that England and other legislative leaders were on with at least one representative of the Trump administration. And apparently the call dealt with the fact that the administration is looking for several states to be incubators for new ways to expand Medicaid under waivers. Is that
remember,
right?
You got it. And remember, Brian Kemp did not put Tom Price on his transition team by accident. And Tom Price is not there, as Galloway wrote, to help hash out his gun policy or his rural broadband plan. It is all for healthcare. And Tom Price, as the former HHS secretary, knows a thing or two about waivers and, you know, how a state can be more innovative in using that funding. So I expect that the state to go in that direction pretty quickly.
Patricia, the quote from Terry England is, "What we understand from the administration in numerous ways, numerous conversations, is that they're open to just about any kind of waiver proposals from states that would help address that working poor category."
Yes. And if you go back to when Obamacare was to be repealed in the Senate, and there was that dramatic vote where John McCain came in and did his thumbs down, a significant amount of the opposition to repealing Obamacare and the Medicaid piece of it, the Medicaid expansion piece, were from Republican governors, specifically in Arizona and Ohio. There are states run by Republicans who have had enormous success in expanding Medicaid or people's access to Medicaid. And it really tends to cut across Republican areas of states where it is or older, rural, less affluent, though that is exactly where hospitals are closing down and leaving many of their constituents with really no options except to get in the car for 4 hours and drive back to Atlanta. So it's obviously Grady and an urban population feel that they would benefit from it, but it's really the rural states that have got to have a solution to this situation.
Amy, I'm not quite sure what waivers mean. It's a very broad term. During the campaign, I think I'm correct that Brian Kemp, when he talked about waivers, talked about them in terms of supplementing affordable care fees that people were already paying to get insurance. And that's probably valuable, but it's not the same as insuring the folks who don't have insurance. And I'm not sure that's where he's headed, but that was what he talked about.
Yeah, I think what's difficult is nobody's entirely sure what a waiver looks like. And so there's a lot of sort of different things that are being rolled out. So certainly one version is to try to give a little bit of extra subsidy for those who have insurance but are having issues paying premiums. Another place where we've seen a lot of information on waivers is perhaps putting some sort of additional perhaps work requirement on it, or showing that you've been involved in community service so that then you're able to be able to, if you are like within a certain, like to expand the number of people that go for Medicaid or something like that, to be able to put in. There's also what I think is probably what the Trump administration has talked a lot about recently. And so I'm not sure if the Kemp administration is thinking about looking this as well, is limited health plans so that there's access that you're getting and perhaps even increasing on what that income level is that's able to get access to it, but it's not the full range of healthcare. So it might have higher deductibles, it might cover less of the particular things, or perhaps waiving some of those essential benefits and things like that.
And this all dovetails into another fight that's going to happen in the legislature next year over certificate of need. It's a very wonky term, but essentially those are the regulations that guide how hospitals can operate, what services they can offer, because hospitals really don't want some outside, you know, some small startup to start taking away some of their more lucrative offerings, while the hospitals still have to do emergency rooms, operate emergency rooms, and the other things that don't make them as much money. And so there's a really consensus among some lawmakers that this coming year is the year to roll back some of those certificate of need regulations, and this could be hand in hand with some sort of Medicaid waiver
In fact, Scott Hocum, Democrat Scott Hocum, was on our show on Friday. He's of course a legislator, and he said the same thing. And of course, the certificate of need, Patricia, could be for something like a hospital spends a lot of money on a new MRI machine or the latest technology for diagnosing various illnesses. They don't want to compete, once they've put that money in, to the hospital down the street who goes and buys the same piece of equipment. So that's particularly important in metro Atlanta, where you have a heavier concentration of medical services. And Hochum suggested that as a Democrat, he might be willing to look at a trade between a certificate of need and Medicaid for to cover more Georgians.
Yeah, it does seem like the stars could really align in this year because it's not an election year, because the heat would be off of any kind of a deal that you would have to make as governor for Brian Kemp, that he could reach across the aisle with Democrats and say, what can I sort of deliver for Metro Atlanta that it's also going to be good for my for the people who have made a lot of promises to in rural Georgia. And so it seems like if anything's going to move in the next 2 years, it will be something that moves in the next 2 months.
Yeah, that's really important. This is not likely to happen in an election year, is it?
Yeah, this is the big opportunity for Brian Kemp, because in election year, A, everyone's going to get out of the Capitol as quickly as possible to start running for re-election. And everything will be even more hyper-partisanized because David Perdue will be on the ballot. Donald Trump will be on the ballot. Everything's up for grabs.
Here's what's interesting, and I throw this out to all of you, but Amy, I'll give you the first shot at this. The AJC, you all did an interview with David Ralston the other day. Ralston said that, in effect, it was Jim who did that interview, and Ralston said that the problem that he sees with expanding Medicaid is that he doesn't trust the federal money will be there to cover it. Well, Amy, if a federal judge now says that Medicaid is illegal, unconstitutional, that plays right into the scenario that Ralston's talking about, where he fears that we might expand, and the next thing you know, the rug is pulled out from under us, and federal funds suddenly dry up, and the states left to pay the bills.
Which is a fair concern. I mean, and really, I think the issue that we've had for, you know, particularly the last 2 years and maybe sort of four before that, is this idea of not really having stability in what the system is going to look like on the federal level, especially with all of the efforts to repeal and replace. Part of the issue was it wasn't clear what the replacement was, right? What it would do, where it would happen, what was going to be the rollout, where this was going to have. And it really is creating in a lot of these markets, right? Even for the employer-based markets and creating a lot of uncertainty. And it's very much so in something like the Medicaid expansion. And that's a thing, too. I mean, there's a real reason for states to be worried about that, because it's a, you know, sort of a large term, but it's unfunded mandates, right? These come down from the federal government a lot where they say do X, but they don't actually give the states the funds to do it. And that can be a problem, especially in a state which doesn't have a lot of wiggle room in its budget, where it's got to be able to figure out where that extra money comes from. And so I think that is of concern. But on the other side, there's also, especially in these rural areas that we're talking about, you've got hospitals leaving in a lot of places. There's not good coverage of care. And you also have an aging population in these areas, which means that healthcare costs are going to rise. And so those tensions are going to come into play. And so something's got to be done.
And Ralston's position kind of characterizes the general GOP in Georgia opposition.
Right.
They say that, yeah, the federal government will pick up 90% or so the first couple years of the Medicaid expansion fees, but not there's no guarantee for long term. What Democrats have tapped into is the sentiment that a majority of the population is in poll after poll after poll supports Medicaid expansion, and that includes many rural Georgians, too. And as Amy mentioned, rural hospitals are closing left and right. We've had a number, more than a dozen, have closed or in financial distress, and there's no answer to that.
But also, if for every year that Georgia does not expand Medicaid, they are leaving hundreds of millions of dollars on the table.
Federal money, yeah.
Yes, federal money. Those are years where Georgia taxpayers are obviously continuing to send their money into the IRS, and we are essentially subsidizing other states' Medicaid expansion instead of our own Medicaid expansion. For Ralston, it's very legitimate to say we don't know what's going to happen with Obamacare, but what we do know is that there is a critical mass of states that have already expanded Medicaid, so there would be an enormous impetus on Congress. There's no way Congress could ever leave town without finding a solution for these states if they are left holding the bag. There's no way that Ohio, Arizona, California, New York, that those House members and senators are going to say, oh, good luck with that 90% we said we'd pay you. Forget it. You know, there's no way.
All right. Obviously, it's going to be an interesting issue to watch once the legislature convenes in mid-January, January 14th, I think.
January 14th.
January 14th.
You'll be there, won't you? Bluestein?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, of course you will. As long as we're talking about healthcare issues and the state, Greg, let's talk about a somewhat parochial issue in the sense that it's really inside baseball. That has to do with Senator Renee Underman, who has been the chair of the Health and Human Health Committee, essentially, in the Senate, and who's been a pretty powerful advocate for any number of health care reforms. She's not in favor with Brian Kemp. What's happening with this?
Or apparently Senate leadership, too. And there's all sorts of talks about reshuffling committee chairs. And hers is the one that keeps on coming up. And I got a call out of the blue from a Democratic senator in Freddie Powell Sims from the Albany area, who said that I don't usually wade into Republican politics, but I am going to wade into this one. I support Renee Underman. And I was kind of, you know, taken aback by that. I did not think that that was why she was calling me. Of all the things to talk about, I thought it was Hurricane Michael or something like that. But it was one of those sort of rare shows of bipartisanship when it comes to Senate committee leadership. And she said, the reason I support Renee Underman is not because she's a supporter of Medicaid expansion, which she is.
Yes.
But it's because she's the one who she's the Senate committee chairwoman who shows up when needed. And that means that for her, that meant after Hurricane Michael, that meant getting some more information about infant mortality rates, about opioid abuse, about helping the only doctor in Clay County keep her doors open because her facility is so run down that that apparently Senator Underman's helped sort of get some sort of deal with Mercer University to build a new facility. So basically said the election's over. Now it's time to find the best leaders for these committees. And this Democratic state senator said Renee Underman's the woman.
It got pretty ugly with Underman during the campaign. It, not Brian Kemp himself, but one of his campaign spokespeople, really, when she criticized Kemp, basically raised questions about her mental
sanity.
Health.
Yeah. Said that she needed to get back on her medication. So they had a very icy relationship. And remember, Senator Underman was not just a supporter of Casey Hagel, but probably one of his top deputies in the Senate, and was in line for some sort of state health department leadership post had he won. And so it was real. She took it real personally, I think, after Casey Cagle lost. But they've seemed to have made amends.
You know, they have. Do you imagine she will retain her position as chair of the committee?
You
don't know.
Yeah, it's looking doubtful, though.
All right.
We'll find out in the next couple of days.
Well, here's what's one of the other things politically that's interesting about this, Patricia, is here's a Republican suburban woman in a county, Gwinnett, that Republicans lost in the gubernatorial. I mean, they need people like Renee Underman to try to rebuild what they've lost in the North Metro counties.
They just may not think they need her. You know, yeah. I think that any politician goes out on a limb if you choose to criticize a member of your party during a campaign. If that person comes back and says, you know, I think I don't really need you as the head of that committee, that's not actually unusual.
No,
and
it's
you certainly
very
should.
Politics.
You should expect it. You know,
yeah.
I've gone out on a limb and I made the wrong choice. However, for Republicans, I think optically, if they choose not to go with Renee Underman, they certainly need to find a way to promote another woman, specifically a suburban woman who could someday in this lifetime get on Atlanta TV and present a face of this party that is not an old white man.
And there's only one other suburban Republican woman in the state Senate, and that's Kate Kirkpatrick from the sort of a Cobb-ish area.
So they'll need to put her in bubble wrap, make sure she's taken very well to, you know, well taken care of, and promote her like crazy if they're smart.
All right. Amy, you want to weigh in, or we are ready to move on?
I agree with what's been said.
Okay. Yeah. Let's move on to the criminal justice reform bill that passed in the Senate last night, Greg. I think 87-12, one of the few bipartisan measures to get through the Congress since the president was sworn in 2016. And President Trump can justifiably say that this was a victory for him. He's been promoting this. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was one of the people who led the charge on criminal justice reform. And Mitch McConnell was a sticking point for a while. There were conservative Republicans in his conference who were worried that it would look they'd look soft on crime. Tom Cotton, Ted Cruz. But in the long run, the president said, McConnell, you better get to a vote on this. and it passed overwhelmingly.
And this bill has deep Georgia ties. Remember, the president had Governor Deal up to the White House not so long ago, just a few months ago, to talk about his approach to criminal justice. Parts of the bill are modeled after Georgia's state-level approach. And remember, in the House, one of the lead sponsors is Doug Collins, who represents one of the most conservative districts east of the Mississippi.
Yeah, in the U.S. House, of course, we're talking
in the
about
US
now.
House.
Doug Collins worked very hard for this measure, Amy.
Definitely. I mean, there's a lot of Georgia ties to this measure, and it does a lot of, you know, doesn't matter which side of the aisle that you're on, right? There's a reason the ACLU is supporting it as strongly as, right, President Trump was, that it does a lot to address many of the issues that are happening, right? There are sort of the unintended consequences that have developed from some of the strict mandatory minimum laws, and especially the sort of 2- and 3-strike laws, where if somebody committed a second or a third felony, they got life in prison. Turns out, A, it's really expensive, and B, sometimes what counts as a felony is not what we think of as a felony, and that was sending people for what seemed like very minor crimes to life in prison and things like that. And so shifting there, and also, again, trying to do sort of more of the diversionary tactics. And so I think that, you know, Georgia can feel really good about the fact that we really were one of the first ones to sort of revolutionize, right, or reform the criminal justice system, the juvenile justice system as well. A lot of people worked really hard on that around the same time, and it had a big impact.
You know, Patricia, another interesting Georgia tie is that Ralph Reed's Faith and Freedom Coalition has been for a number of years now, I think about 3 years, has been pushing through its members for criminal justice reform as well, which may seem counterintuitive. And maybe it's something Tom Cotton and a Ted Cruz ought to have thought of been thinking about when an organization that is considered that conservative, in fact, in this context, says, no, social justice demands change.
Yes. So if you look at somebody like Doug Collins, a pastor, and he teamed up with Hakeem Jeffries, I mean, he really was the author of this bill. The two of them authored this bill together, and it shows the incredible breadth of the political coalition that was required to get a bill like this through. And so you had the Congressional Black Caucus, Freedom Works, Jared Kushner was a huge part of moving this bill forward. Ted Cruz eventually got on board as well. And it really did take also, though, those Republican governors going to Bedminster. Nathan Deal told the president that being smart on crime is different from being tough on crime, because on the campaign trail, Donald Trump was not remotely interested in this issue. And he talks a lot about, obviously, lock him up, lock her up, lock them all up. He really was not particularly involved on this issue. And it really took a very broad coalition. It's the first example I've seen this year of really old-fashioned legislating, of building a coalition, of individually picking off member after member after member, making a deal with McConnell to, at the very least, get a vote after the election, and here we are.
It felt like the old days.
I love it.
I mean, look at another Georgia parallel. Look, I had a chance to sit down with the Governor Deal this morning to talk about his legacy. And in 2010, this was also not the centerpiece of his agenda by any means. It was a part of it, but it was not the centerpiece. And back then, you wouldn't have, you know, made the prediction that 8 years later you would look back at criminal justice reforms and think that was the biggest, one of his biggest accomplishments. But it certainly was. And he did the same thing. He said, "Look, if I had gone into this and tried to do it all comprehensive in one big piece, it would never have passed, and I would have had a big whopping failure early in my term." But instead, he did it in an 8-year process. That extended till this very year, and was able to get these initiatives done, working from one lawmaker to another, and getting most of his part of the package approved overwhelmingly. And he said this morning, he said it's an affirmation that states can set examples for the federal government. Then he got a little emotional. He said he hears frequently from people who are given second chances because of the state's overhaul, and he started choking up and says, "Those are the kinds of results that affect the individual lives of people. Government ought to be able to do that, positively affect the lives of citizens."
That's great. When are you running that piece? When will people be able
to? Well, that quote will be in tomorrow's piece for today, but okay, There'll be a bigger piece in early January.
A couple of quick things. I know we're late for a break, but bear with me there in the control room. Amy, I think it's fair to say that at least a good portion of why this reform bill has been so important is because it is an effort to deal with the fact that the criminal laws in this country have been disproportionately harsh on African-American defendants, right?
or at least disproportionately harsh on minority defendants, as well as those who are lower socioeconomic status. The literature on this, the studies that have been done on it, are really very clear that you see not only are minorities and those of lower socioeconomic status more likely to be simply arrested for crimes, they're also more likely to then be charged and sentenced. And a lot of times those sentences are disproportionate. I've had a number of students that have done projects looking at it, and you find that if you sort of control for everything else, that on average, someone who's a minority is going to get a longer sentence as well. And they're also going to be charged more strictly, which has it directly correlates to what kind of sentence you're going to get. And so it's a concern.
All right. I want to get to a break. But before I do, fun fact, Robert Jimison just pulled up on the magic Google machine a piece of information. Nathan Deal gives to every new judge in the state a gavel made by state prisoners. Good work, Jimison. All right. I want to talk about this a little bit more because, in fact, Nathan Deal gets credit for having been an inspiration and a model for some of what is now almost certain to be signed by the president into law after the House goes back and takes one more crack at it. But there's a bookend effect here. Because Governor Zell Miller was in the leading wave that was leaning in the exact opposite direction. And I think it's kind of be fun, if nothing else, to play a little of Zell Miller on that. And we'll do that right after the break.
They say it takes 30 days to form a habit. Hi, I'm Ophira Eisenberg. And if your New Year's resolution is to be more informed, you don't need 30 days. Make a year-end gift right now, and you'll start a good habit immediately. And when you commit to monthly giving, you know you'll stick with it. It's a lot easier and less painful than going to the gym more. So get ahead on your goals. You just have to get behind us.
Make your tax-deductible year-end gift now. Go to gpb.org or call 800-222-4788.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Okay, so Nathan Deal gets credit, as we've just discussed, for inspiring to some extent, helping model the criminal justice reform that is has been dealt with in Congress now. But in 1994, Zell Miller, Governor Miller, who was in that year going to face a reelection campaign by the end of the year, gave a State of the State address in which he became one of the early proponents, not of let's reform how we punish, but let's get even tougher on how we punish. And he became a leader nationally in terms of getting tougher. Listen to just a little of that January 11th, 1994 State of the State speech.
In Georgia, I want it to be where if you do the crime, you are going to do the time. No parole, no loopholes, no exceptions. And once a criminal has committed a second violent felony, that's right, second, I want him gone from society. We will give them a second chance to be responsible citizens. But that's all they get. Some talk about three strikes and you're out. That's in baseball. Violent crime is no game. In Georgia, I want the rule to be two strikes and you're gone. Gone forever.
And you know, Amy, that was received with rousing enthusiasm by the legislature, and Zell passed the measures that he talked about. But in fact, that really was current thinking in the 90s on how to deal with the growing crime rates around the country.
It definitely was. So there was nothing about that in many ways that put it out of the ordinary, that was sort of following in line. I mean, we saw, most people don't remember this, he has recently corrected it, but Jerry Brown was also in favor of doing similar laws in California, right? Moonbeam Jerry is the same one who put those into place at exactly the same time, because sort of in that period. And I think one of the things that we've realized sort of, you know, over time, that one of the kind of unintended consequences of it was a recognition that, number one, what was not happening were efforts to try to help someone go back into society. So that was sort of number one, that a lot of that was also cut out of the prisons. And so part of the problem was, if you're let out of prison and you don't have any money and you don't have a job, what are you supposed to do? Now, that doesn't mean that one should necessarily go commit a crime, but it does make it very difficult, right, especially if you don't know how to do anything else. And the second part of it, which really ran into issues, were, again, this sort of question of what fits in the felony category for the 2 and 3 strikes laws, that there were a number of people where they were falling under the rubric of this, which were not what we were thinking, right? It wasn't the armed robberies, it wasn't violent rapes, it wasn't murder, but it was sometimes even someone stealing a can of beans, but because of where they had done it. And so that was causing issues too, and so needing to look back over it.
Well, I think also Zell Miller and a lot of Democrats, including Bill Clinton, were responding to the politics of Willie Horton. They're in a new political era, and it is time for Democrats to get serious on crime or else lose their next election. I think that was really important. And that was apparently in the mind of Donald Trump until earlier this year. He said, well, what about Willie Horton? Because Jared Kushner would go to him and say, we need to do this. He said, what about Willie Horton? I'm going to get killed in the next election if somebody gets out and commits a crime. And it took Kim Kardashian coming to the White House and advocating for Alice Marie Johnson, who had been locked up for life for a nonviolent offense, to really convince him. And so I would say between Kim Kardashian and Charles Kushner, who was Jared Kushner's father, who also went to prison and sort of opened his own eyes to what really happens in prison and who is really there, those were probably the two most important people in this conversation for the president.
Thank you. Those are really interesting insights. Greg, one of the things that came back to bite Zell Miller in the rear end on this was that the state prison started filling to overflowing. Yeah. People would be, if you were arrested in a given local jurisdiction, you'd be sent to the county jail, of course, to await trial. Those jails were filling up. Suddenly, counties had to pay the costs of housing those prisoners. One of the most infamous incidents that Zell Miller had to contend with, having passed this law, was when the then sheriff of DeKalb County, Pat Jarvis, became so incensed about the fact that he could not send any of the convicted prisoners in his jail to state prisons where they belonged, was that he showed up one day during a legislative session with, I believe, 3 buses loaded with his county inmates, and went in and said, what are you going to do with these people?
Yeah, and look, and it also bred questions about the conditions of jails, the expense for backlogs, the requirement that defendants get an initial hearing within 72 hours. A lot of that was being missed. All sorts of lawsuits from the ACLU and other civil rights groups that were targeting Georgia's approach to criminal justice. And what you've seen is a total sea change. And it's not just in Georgia, Texas and other conservative states also. It's called the Right on Crime movement. And what will be really interesting to see is how Brian Kemp approaches this debate. We all know that Stacey Abrams kind of positioned herself as the heir to Deal's criminal justice legacy. She was going to continue to decriminalize certain nonviolent and drug offenses. Brian Kemp said what Governor Deal did was great, and he was going to go in a different direction, that he was going to start increasing penalties for violent criminals.
All right. Let's move on. Patricia Murphy, you had a terrific column in Roll Call. I think it was published yesterday, day before, something like that?
It was on Tuesday, Okay. Whatever day today is.
Today's Wednesday. Wednesday. Okay. The headline, I'm not sure that you write the headlines, but we'll read it anyway. Happy New Year, Republicans. It's downhill from here. Your lead says 2018 will go in the books as a bad one for most Republicans. They picked up 2 seats in the Senate, but lost 40 in the House, including losing the 6th District in Georgia. Their numbers among women in the House shrank from 23 to 13, and President Donald Trump can't give away his chief of staff job. Ask anyone who's been there, the only thing worse than losing the majority in Congress is every day after that, and you go on from there. Talk to us about what you're anticipating in 2019 on the Hill.
Yes, well, I actually did write that headline.
Oh, okay.
some of them I don't get right, but that one they kept.
That was a good headline.
So I don't know if there's a way for Republican members, especially the ones who are not around for the last Democratic majority, to fully appreciate how different their lives are about to be, because it goes from running the agenda, chairing the committee hearings, essentially ignoring the minority party to any extent that you choose to. And now they're on the other side of that. This will be Nancy Pelosi, who is just an incredibly skilled negotiator and legislator. And the committees will now be chaired by Democrats instead of Republicans. And I think Democrats believe that part of their mandate this time around was to provide congressional oversight to a president who appears to have had very little or none. There are 18 House committees with the authority to investigate the president, the administration, the cabinet secretaries, the spending, his bank records, every 18 of those chairmen will have investigations going.
One of the points that you make in this column that certainly will relate to Georgia as the 2020 election cycle picks up is that, if you're a winning football, if you're the University of Georgia right now, if you're Alabama, you can recruit anybody you want.
Yes.
Well, there's a corollary that you point out in Congress. Republicans, given that they're on the losing end of the cycle and that they got all these things swarming in the atmosphere, recruiting could be a real problem for them as they try to get good candidates for 2020.
Yes. Even though President Trump has demonstrated his ability to win elections, it's been very hard for other Republicans to win those elections. And as I like to say, you can't sell tickets on the Titanic. You know, if somebody is trying to decide, do I want to start this process now? Do I want to start it 2 years from now after we know what's happening? What has happened with the Mueller investigation? Has President Trump won his election or not? There are so many unknowns between now and 2020. Any smart Republican who wants to have a career after 2020, I think, stays on the sidelines.
Yeah, Amy, this is a real challenge. And it'll be interesting to see how it makes an impact on Georgia. I mean, I suppose Republicans here feel like the state has remained, for the most part, reliably red statewide. But that's certainly starting to change in congressional districts around the state. So it's going to be interesting to see what kind of candidates come forward on the Republican side people who are not already incumbents, of course.
Well, and the second thing that goes along with that is also that there was just recently released news that the RNC is already planning for 2020, that they will basically merge their ground game with the Trump campaign, which is a huge deal, right? That's not ever really been done. Usually the party and the campaign run separately. It's notable partly that they've determined this before there's even been a primary, because we don't know technically who the Republican nominee will be. But the other thing that it does is it much more directly ties sort of the two together in this support. And one of the things that I think that we saw, maybe not as much in Georgia, though to some degree, right, was this sort of real question of distancing, right, whether or not you're going to run with Trump or run away with Trump. I remember one of the meetings that we had, it was before Trump was coming down to campaign with Governor Kemp. And we had sort of a debate going of whether or not Karen Handel and Rob Woodall were going to go meet with Trump. And both Jim and Greg said, no, he didn't, right? They both didn't, because they didn't want to go near, right? They were going to say, we're glad that he came. But at the same time, they knew that their voters weren't going to respond to that. And so it's bringing up those sort of same issues, especially as you're trying to recruit candidates.
Well, you just made a good point. I mean, Greg, 7th District. We may have a completely open seat by 2020. There's rumors that could be the case.
Rob Woodall wouldn't run for another term.
Yeah. Then the question becomes, how strong a Republican wants to jump into that race? Again, you know, the 7th is on the edge. I just wonder about it.
I mean, I don't think there'll be any shortage of interest in either 6th or 7th.
Okay.
Karen Handel's still looking at a rematch. If not her, Brandon Beach has talked to some people about maybe her interest. The interesting thing will be those other not quite as vulnerable seats. Sanford Bishop has long been, sort of a dream for Republicans to target. Will any credible Republicans get in that race?
Yeah.
I don't think so, right?
I doubt it, yeah. All right. Patricia, what Amy just talked about to me was really a remarkable story that broke the other day. The RNC and the Trump campaign are going to essentially merge into one mega campaign organization. To some extent, given that Rona McDaniel, the RNC chair, has been, I mean, as close to, you know, she is so devoted to Trump, it may not be surprising she would agree to that. But that's unheard of, and it could be a very powerful force for good and ill for Republicans.
Sure. Or you, there was news this morning that the South Carolina Republican Party is considering having no primary at all in South Carolina in order to prevent an early challenge to President Trump in a potential Republican primary. So it's very clear that Republicans have made the decision, we are with this president. There will be no daylight. And most of the never Trumpers, the sort of Trumpers, lost their elections the last time around. So the Republican Party that is left is Donald Trump's party. And any pretense that that's not the case really is just not really honest at this point.
One of the things about combining those resources is it could create real problems if you wanted to challenge Donald Trump. If you're John Kasich wanting to run as a challenger in the Republican Party, but the RNC is already working with Trump. Anyhow, that'll be interesting. All right, wait a minute. I've got to stop everything. Greg Bluestein, this is how this man works. He is sitting here participating fully in our program. And I learned from Faust and Jimison, he's also tweeting news while he's sitting here. What's the news about Stacey Abrams you just tweeted out?
Stacey Abrams just joined the board of the directors of the Center for American Progress. So another sign that she's staying very, very involved in the political scene. She's, as we've talked about before, not only does she still have TV ads, but they're going beyond voting to talk about healthcare and signing up for Obamacare, the healthcare exchange. And also at the same time, she's launched her Fair Fight Action legal organization to try to force changes to the Georgia voting system. So she's got her hand in a lot of different pots right now. Well, she's staying very involved.
And she was the most Googled politician of 2018, period.
Yeah.
So if you are somebody like Stacey Abrams and you've been looking to make your way up the ladder for a long time, if that's your Google result, you're not going anywhere.
Yeah. We know why our clicks went up this past year.
Yes.
There's also, of course, been rumors, Greg, that she could be, let me be clear about this. I'm not sure whether this has really been talked about by the highest levels of the Democratic Party leadership, but there's been thoughts that she would actually make a terrific chair of the Democratic National Committee.
There's been a lot of talk. I mean, there's been talk about that. There's been talking about her as a VP or even a potential presidential candidate. There's been talk about her running for the Senate against David Perdue in 2020. I still think the most likely course of action for her seems to be just talking to people around her, a rematch against Brian Kemp in 2022. But if that's the case, she's going to find some way beyond what we've already talked about to stay relevant that long, because 4 years is a long time away.
All right, let's do this. Let's get another break out of the way. When we come back, we've got more to talk about on today's Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, Iraq's cruel and corrupt campaign of revenge. We talk with Ben Taub of The New Yorker. He reports that now that ISIS has been driven out of most of Iraq, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, including women and children, are being detained, tortured, killed, or cast out of society suspected of associating with ISIS. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB and gpbnews.org.
Every day, GPB brings you fact-based news coverage, engaging interviews, and smart entertainment you don't find elsewhere, all thanks to your support. Before 2018 comes to a close, please do your part to keep public broadcasting strong here in Georgia and beyond. Make your tax-deductible year-end gift now. Go to gpb.org or call 800-222-4788. That's gpb.org or 800-222-4788. Thank you and happy holidays.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Patricia Murphy, Amy Steigerwalt, and Greg Bluestein are with us in the studio today. As I mentioned at the top of the show, they also were with us earlier today when we recorded a best stories in Georgia politics, top 10 stories in 2018. And it was a great conversation. Jim Galloway joined us for it. We're going to air it next Monday, Christmas Eve at 2 o'clock. It'll be on TV The following Sunday morning at 9 o'clock, and I think we're also going to air it again on New Year's Eve at 2 in the afternoon. So lots of opportunities to hear it. All right, let's talk, Greg, about this Winthrop University poll. Winthrop University asked, they talked to residents in 11 states. This was not a poll of registered voters, likely voters. This was a poll in the general population. So they removed it from any kind of partisan leaning that you might expect pollsters to want to try to assess. There are some fascinating findings in this. One of them is that more than half of all residents in the 11 southern states they polled, of course including Georgia, believed that the United States was founded as an explicitly Christian nation. Research, the director of the poll says, research has shown that increases in Christian nationalist beliefs lead to more exclusionary views on immigration and more negative views of multiculturalism in America. Those who hold these views care more about whether they have a strong leader who will protect their religious and cultural values than whether a leader is individually pious. So there's a political spin on a non-political poll.
You got it. And another really interesting development from this poll was that the support for the Confederate battle flag took a hit. 55% said the banner was about Southern pride, but only 44% were willing to give it their personal endorsement. And 38% of white adults viewed the flag unfavorably. Another 19% said they didn't know. So that was a big shift from the last time this poll took place, too.
Yeah, yeah. Although, Amy, you know, the fact that 55%, they don't want to fly the flag. That's clear. A plurality don't. But the fact that 55% still insist that it's a symbol of Southern pride and not a remnant of the South's racially troubled past still says something about where our attitudes in this part of the country are at today.
Well, there's a reason that it is taught as you're growing up about the War of Northern Aggression and not, of course, the Civil War.
Is that how it was taught to you?
Oh, most decidedly.
Okay. Was it you too?
Not
you.
Not Rush Springs.
Okay.
Oh, yes. We heard about the War of Northern Aggression. You certainly heard about, you know, that the, you know, states' rights and all of that. And so I think that there still is that. There's a lot of people who don't know the history also of even the Georgia flag that we had in the 1950s, right? We switched the one that there were a lot of people that had no idea that that one was put into place in 1956 as a direct response to Brown versus Board of Education. And so some of that definitely goes into there. Though an interesting side note on actually the response about the Christian nation, I'm going to give a plug actually for research, a Polish piece that one of my colleagues did, Sarah Gershon, that looked at attitudes of immigrants. And one of the things that they found was that immigrants, and particularly Asian immigrants, are much more likely to view, and those who have now applied for citizenship, to view being Christian as part of sort of what makes you American, as part of the national identity, than other things. And so some of that could also be, ironically enough, the growing immigrant populations and the fact that for a lot of people when they're brought in, there is sort of this attachment between sort of coming to the United States and also because they're a lot of times brought in by church groups and things like that, that there's much more of a linkage given to them between sort of what citizenship means and Christianity.
Patricia, when you saw this, what thoughts did you have?
I have to say, I actually thought the South is a little more progressive than I thought it was going to be, to be very honest with you.
Good.
For 58% of the population to believe that it is, that the, especially the Confederate flag is a symbol of Southern pride,
yeah, pride.
And heritage, that's lower than it was. I think that we've had a much more fulsome discussion about what the flag means to a number of people. And I would point specifically to the shooting at Emmanuel Baptist Church in Charleston and the conversation in South Carolina about bringing the state flag off of, the Confederate flag off of state property, and hearing a lengthy debate from descendants of slaveholders about what that flag means to them. And I think that opened the eyes of a number of white Southerners of saying, well, I know what I was told it meant when I grew up. Obviously, that's very different for other people who I live next to and live among. And so I think that I actually see this as a sign of progress, having been brought up in a state where not only was it called, when I went to school, it wasn't called the War of Northern Aggression. It was just called the War. There was no other war. This was it. It just cast such a long shadow. And I think I see this as incremental progress, actually.
All right. I find that interesting. I guess because I'm a Chicagoan who found myself in the South 35 years ago, I think I've told this story before. The last campaign that I covered when I lived in Chicago was the campaign in which Harold Washington became the first African-American mayor of Chicago. It was a huge story. But when Harold went into some of the white neighborhoods on the northwest side, particularly of the city, it was dangerous to cover him because people would throw bottles, cans, rocks. They didn't care. The epithets that were hurled at him were horrendous. He won. Shortly after he won, I announced to my colleagues in the newsroom at the ABC local newsroom up there, I was coming to Georgia, and everybody said, how can you possibly want to move to the racist South? And I said, have we all lived through the same election, people? You know, Greg, this kind of double standard. I mean, I get that the South has a dark history and one that we continue to grapple with, but we're not alone.
No, not at all. I mean, a lot of the northern states have, and they're even more segregated than the South can be as well, from schools to neighborhoods to cities.
But I will say that when you listen to, I think his name is Scott Huffman, who is the director of the poll, when he describes what a belief that this is a white Christian nation means, it does tend to move into the political. These are the very values that people voted for Donald Trump over.
Yeah, I mean, he said that in this view, those who hold these views care more about whether they have a strong leader who protect their religious and cultural values than whether a leader is individually pious.
Okay. I just thought it was interesting. The presidential campaign is absolutely starting. There's no question it is underway. I was hoping we're going to get to talk about it today. We won't get a lot of time, but Amy, what do we expect? Are we going to see 15 to 20 Democratic candidates want to take on President Trump?
Well, I think right now we've got at least 15 that are being thrown into the early polls for people to get an early idea. My bet is that my prediction, which of course could be massively wrong, but likely we're going to start to see that narrow down to about four or five over the next 6 months, especially as people decide whether or not they're actually going to formally win, put in committee, and raise money.
And of course, that's the first part of the game, isn't it, Patricia? The first vote is over writing checks. Who gets the money and who doesn't?
It is. But I have to say, on the Democrat and Democratic side especially, there is this really new way to fundraise off of small dollar donors through Act Blue that has absolutely revolutionized what it means to run in a primary. It's also so much less expensive to run because of so much free social media and free airtime you can get if you just light your hair on fire. I think that we're going to have a large field for some time because I remember covering the Iowa caucuses and the debates leading up to that were like a clown car of 17 candidates. And the adult
two
table
shifts.
And yeah. The kids table.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're out of time. I brought that up just very briefly because starting in January, we're going to see that field. We're going to have one person after another announce, and we'll be covering it all right here on Political Rewind, especially if Georgia does become a state that is competitive in the 2020 race. We're completely out of time for today's show. Amy, Patricia, Greg, thanks so much, not only for being here for this show, but doing double duty and doing that great year-end Top 10 show that we air next week. I appreciate all of you and your participation with us. And I appreciate all of you out there. I will see you again on Friday at 2 o'clock. In the meantime, get that Christmas shopping done now.